Today we are talking to Brian Powell, the Director of Engineering at Tangram Flex, and we discuss lessons learned from previous startups, cutting through the noise when launching a product, and the core principles of prototyping for production. All of this right here, right now on the Modern CTO Podcast.
Here we go!
This is the Modern CTO Podcast.
So your office that you're at now,
mm-hmm.
what company is that? Because I know you did some moving around, some hopscotching.
Yeah. So, Complete Set, the startup that I was with down in Cincinnati, actually coming in the second week of January, we ran out of cash, as startups do. So Went back into the market looking for, different opportunities, and actually landed with a new spinoff that's soon to be announced here. From the parent company called Galois, which is based out of Portland, Oregon, but I'll be based in the Cincinnati Dayton area.
Interesting. So I want to know about Complete Set.
Yeah.
Because I'm just curious, because this is how we bring value, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
What did Complete Set do?
So Complete Set was this hybrid mashup of eBay meets Amazon meets Wikipedia for collectibles. So we profiled and tracked close to 300 different brands of, products that were coming out. Things from, new stuff like Johnny Cupcakes, which is a t-shirt company out of Boston. Homage, which is, a clothing company out of Columbus, Ohio. To, the big names like Disney and Hasbro and, the Kenner stuff, that Hasbro acquired during that purchase. And so, what we would do is we would sort of track those items as they were released and, sort of track the value of them and what people were trading for them. But at Complete Set, at its core, was really about sort of taking collectors and matching them to the items that they wanted. So they could come in and track their collection, say, hey, I want to go on the hunt for this particular item. And then, what we were doing was sort of taking that information and exposing it to vendors that could then come in and go out and sort of hunt that inventory and match it to, to our audience.
So you're matching collectors with people who had those collectibles.
Exactly. Yep. And we would sort of facilitate that transaction. But then we were also sort of, to keep the marketplace full of stuff, we were doing a consignment model where we, we ran a warehouse, we were taking in, 600-700 piece collections, and then we were liquidating them for people, that were, some of it was, people were sort of changing focus. Maybe they, really were into Star Wars at one point and they wanted to transition over to like movie props or something along those lines. And we would, come in, we'd take that collection from them, we'd do a consignment fee, and then we'd liquidate it. And because we knew what people were searching for inside of our network, we had and we were able to send out the notifications when those things came available. Really, Complete Set was sort of a marketing platform for marketing to people who were looking for specific items.
Right, because that's like your unique information that you have, is who wants
exactly.
What.
Yep.
So then how big of a company was that company? How many people?
So we were about 13 people, including the four people in the warehouse. My development team was a team of six. So
like, I'm curious, was it a lack of the market? Were there a lot of people that were really into collectibles? Or I'm curious as to where it kind of didn't take off the way you guys thought it would, or how the whole thing wrapped up.
So, I think the thing that kind of got us was the assumption was, we had sort of unclear metrics into what our cost to list a particular item was until very, sort of right in the, we layered in the software in middle of September into the fulfillment center, where we went in and we sort of, we took like 6 weeks and wrote a complete custom package for the fulfillment center, from, barcode scanners, bins integrated with photography software, a completely custom shelving system, and Android tablets for picking and packing orders. And, we did that because, Complete Set was, it's not like any other inventory company. We looked around at a couple other solutions. Everything was a quantity of one. It belonged to a specific user. It was in a specific condition. It had a specific price that they wanted for it, or it was going to auction. And, inside of that, capacity, most inventory systems that are out there are, I've got 500 of these items. They show up on a pallet. I need to stick them in a spot in the warehouse. I need to go get them when I need them. And, you know, that just wasn't the solution that we needed. And so, you know, we came in and we built that system, put in a very sort of complex, almost IoT-based, you know, eventing structure of, you know, knowing, okay, this item started to be received, it's been received, it's going to photography, it's in photography, it's out of photography. And that provided us a really granular view of the items that were moving through complete set all the way out from when they came, you know, from when they came in all the way out, you know, through shipping and when they into delivery. And we didn't really get those numbers until October, November timeframe. And we sort of realized that our cost per item that we needed to hit to break even, you know, was around $15. And we started moving towards that through the month of November. And then December killed us. And you would think that December is a great month for, you know, for merchandise. But you're talking about collectors who are using disposable income to buy items that they want. And they're using all of that for family trips and to buy presents. And so revenue sank. We were out raising a little bit of money and we couldn't get it done to come back. So, you know, it happens. It was, you know, the market kind of got us and, you know, we probably should have focused on, you know, more features that really, you know, were less marketplace-y and more recurring revenue. Cause you know, every month, you know, we grew 45% for 3 months in a row, revenue growth. And every month we would start at zero because we were doing, you know, we were doing sort of that marketplace model and we needed to probably put some features in place that allowed us to sort of, you know, if the hill was, you know, let's say $30,000 and you equate that to 30,000 feet, we needed something that would move base camp up 5,000 foot each month to allow us to climb that hill a little easier.
Interesting. What it's so valuable to take a look back at something like this because we're all kind of, we're all in a business and all businesses are susceptible to the market. It's the way the world works. And we all have to watch all the different parts of our companies, primarily the income. And so that's a nice reflection on that. So if you were to do it again, you would say you would focus on the recurring revenue up front so that when you guys had down months like December or seasonally down months, that recurring revenue would take you through.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we were focused on being sort of almost a brick and mortar type of business model, right? Where you got to get this much foot traffic through the door or through your website, right, per month to hit that number. And you've got to figure out how to grow that traffic, you know, but largely our income was tied to how much, you know, how many collections we could pull in. And you go through the holidays and, you know, people aren't going to, you know, ship you a collection of stuff. They're, you know, they're out, they're doing other things. You know, you sort of hit that business lull between Thanksgiving to Christmas where you just can't get anything done. So it was a little bit of a constraint of inventory, but really if we would have had those recurring sort of revenue pieces in place, you know, it could have changed the business pretty substantially because we could have figured out how to grow that specific recurring revenue stream and, you know that we, you know, that was a steady, you know, sort of, you know, steady sort of input into the financial baseline, you know, and then have the marketplace stuff on top of it.
So if you had about 12, 13 people and half of them were engineers, and then what were the other half?
So we had some marketing people, sales guys that were actually like working with people who wanted to sell their collections and sort of go driving them through that process. And then we had the warehouse staff. So we had, you know, a professional photographer on staff. We had, you know, receivers, packers, shippers, et cetera. You know, everything that you would need to run an Amazon-like warehouse to get stuff in and out.
Do you think it would have made a difference if you like only had three engineers and instead got three more salespeople?
Maybe. The focus was, you know, when I sort of joined the company, I came into the company 18 months before we closed. And at that point, they had already released an iOS application and they had released an Android application. And then they had their mobile webs, they had the website. And, you know, from that perspective, you know, I think we all would have agreed that we probably would have pulled back on putting out mobile applications, even though our users were sort of jumping up and down that they wanted them, because almost, you know, like 70 to 75% of our traffic for the company was just on our mobile website. right?
Yeah.
So, you know, the mobile web was getting it done. Did we really need to make that investment in the iOS and the Android applications? But, you know, this decision was largely sort of already made that it was out there. And, you know, the impression was that pulling that back would do more damage than
well, the money was already spent.
Good. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So what's next for you? What are you, where are you at now?
So I'm at a new company that literally just formed about last Monday, called Tangram Flex. And it's really focused on sort of taking functional sort of approaches to programming and applying it to systems engineering. And that's about as deep as I'll go on it. A lot of their work is sort of focused on the government side of things. But, you know, it's really cool. It could the technology that's been developed here could change the way that we sort of approach software development. You know, if it's sort of taking it back to the way that, you know, building codes, you know, there's a whole bunch of algorithms that have been in place for, you know, the way the CAD systems are, you know, are used to sort of, you know, put structures together. And largely a lot of that stuff doesn't exist in the software engineering world. And so when you look at that problem of, you know, how do we increase cybersecurity? How do you increase interoperability of, you know, components? And, you know, how do you sort of take a system and make it very flexible by focusing on the individual pieces of it? You know, this Tangram's approach is really, you know, focused on doing that.
You guys are taking concepts from other complicated engineering projects and then applying them to software engineering projects.
That's exactly right. Yep.
Well, that sounds smart. At the end of the day, there's not going to be like, oh, wait, so is there going to be like building codes and stuff now for software?
I don't know if it's so much that. I think, I don't know if we'll get to that approach. It's really about sort of generating the tooling that allows people to ensure that they're, you know, the projects that they're building, you know, are secure and that they're really flexible and that they can be sort of reconfigured, you know, on the fly.
Good, because otherwise you'd call the company like red tape.
Yeah, pretty much. And I don't think anybody'd buy that. So
no, I don't think you're going to win the hearts and minds of developers that way.
I don't think so either.
Have you ever wanted more oversight in your code?
Yeah. The answer is no. So
have you wanted a board of non-technical people deciding how you write software? No, please no. So that's cool. That sounds actually really interesting because you're taking principles that work in complicated engineering and you're bringing them over just to another industry that seems to lack it, at least to my experience.
Yep.
Very cool. Very cool. So you're pumped about it.
I am. Yeah. It's it was one of those sort of, you know, when the conversation started about it was even hard for me to get it into my head. And, you know, here I am 3 days on the job and just, you know, drowning in all of the information that's coming at me. But, you know, there's glimmers of hope of like, wow, I now understand how this particular, you know, thing is going to go together. And, you know, we're very early on. I mean, I'm employee one of this company and, you know, we're spin off or, you know, we're going to be fully funded. But, you know, it's, we just got to get through this, you know, initial piece of starting to get the building blocks in place and putting together a great team. And, you know, hiring is something that's, you know, hiring effectively in the engineering space is something that's really near and dear to my heart. Cause if you do it wrong, it can be really, really painful for you.
Well, yeah. If you get people that don't know how to build a foundation to build a foundation, good luck building a house.
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
So now you're on this hunt for the best of the best, right?
Correct. Yep.
What technologies are you partial to for this build?
Well, you know, the stuff that we're doing is largely, you know, continuous integration type work. So there's not really a, you know, set of languages or, you know, or things that we're looking, you know, specifically for. And, you know, it's, there's not, we're not inheriting much either. So it's sort of a green, you know, a blue ocean here of, you know, what we could use. And, you know, we get the, unlike some, you know, roles that you step into where it's largely prescribed what you're going to build and what it is. You know, I think that the fundamentals and the, you know, fundamental ideas and the concepts are there, but how it goes together and what it looks like and how it operates, all of that's to be determined. And so, you know, those are the type of projects that are kind of really exciting to step into.
So you're looking for more of like a generalized architect to come on board first with you, and then you guys kind of make those decisions?
So we have the people who've done the original proof of concept with our parent company that sort of, you know, have prescribed the building blocks of those pieces. And now it's just trying to figure out how do we put those building blocks together and what are we going to stick them together with? So,
okay. So you're in that process right now of discovery, of figuring out what technologies you're going to use to take this idea of this proof of concept, this prototype that you have, and then make an MVP out of it.
That's right. Yep.
That's exciting, man. Ooh, there's lots of highs right now. You're in a very
part of it. Yeah. I mean, it's, you're back to every time something clicks a little bit better. You're like, oh, now I get it. Like,
so are you the CTO of this company?
I'm the director of engineering. The two people who've developed the technology have stepped into the interim CTO roles. So the expectation there is that, you know, as we get to sort of this company being fully commercialized, then at that point, you know, they'll transition back to the mothership and, you know, continue to build all the awesome things that they do over there.
Well, they seem pretty smart. I mean, they found you and you sound smart. So
thanks.
So your primary language that you have the most experience, what is that?
I write a lot of my stuff in Go.
Really?
Yeah. So I started in PHP, you know, like most people do when they're sort of hacking stuff together. Fell out of love with PHP, sort of meandered through Ruby. Not really in love with that. You know, then Node popped onto the scene and, you know, became pretty popular. But then, you know, you start to realize all of the drawbacks of writing server side stuff in JavaScript. And then, found Go, and Go is just one of those things that, for, you know, people find a language that just sort of clicks, and I can look at Go and just understand, you know, A, what's going on underneath the hood, but how to sort of build pieces and stick them together.
Yeah, I actually went to a meetup when Go was first coming out. Google had asked a bunch of developers to do talks and stuff, and they described the whole concept of Go, and the guy actually had the language deployed to a satellite, which was really neat. So he had the laptop with him at the talk, and he actually rotated the satellite in space at the talk. It was pretty
cool. Wow.
It was all done in Golang. You ever see that newsletter, the email newsletter, Golang Weekly?
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. Yeah.
We had Peter Cooper of Cooper Press on the show this morning.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, he puts together, that's Cooper Press, does all those like Ruby Weekly, Golang Weekly. So he was a pretty cool dude. We were talking about like startups and content, and the concept of like, when should the startup start making the content, right? Should it be when they have the idea, or should they be secretive and like build the product for 6 months and then write the content, or like at what stage should they be writing the content? And overwhelmingly, the answer was like immediately.
Yep, I agree. I mean, I advise right now, I think my advisory list is around a dozen different startups from, you know, Techstars, Brandery, UpTech here locally. And it's so funny because, you know, this, you know, there's just this this over caution of sharing your idea with someone and the idea that they're going to go steal it. And in most cases, it's like, it's almost laughable, because at the end of the day, it's, you know, just, you know, get out there and build your product as fast as you can. And, you know, if you're not telling anybody about it, you're probably not marketing or doing a very good job of getting people to your product. So you just need to be as loud and as noisy as possible with your particular marketing for your idea.
Yeah. So, and they also don't have to necessarily like they don't have to find and focus on the one, like something that's proprietary and should be quiet, like, right. And then go pick that one. They could literally just start with the journey, start writing articles about the problem, start weekly up. You could generate all of this other content around it, so that in 6 months when your product launches, or in 3 months or whatever, you have this long repository, this history. And when people start searching for that question, when you start selling the product in 6 months, they're finding you through the content you wrote from day one.
Absolutely. I mean, you could just have a landing page saying, hey, sign up for my email, right? I've seen a lot of companies do, you know, get a huge following just from, you know, like, you know, to your point, starting the content and just at the bottom of that saying, hey, to keep up to date with what we're doing here, you know, give us your email address and we'll just include you in it. So.
So are you guys going to be doing that then?
I don't know. So, I mean, we're so early in this, and, you know, a lot of the clients and stuff like that we're working with, I don't know if, that would necessarily resonate with them. Probably the second to third phase of this particular company, that'll definitely be the case. I mean, we don't even have a logo yet. That's how like kind of fresh this thing is. So, but we're engaging the marketing teams and stuff like that, sometime in the near future to get all of that stuff rolling.
Very cool. All right. So yeah, because I think that topic, the functional approaches or like taking ideas from other complicated engineering segments of the market and then applying them, there's like, that's a huge pile of content you could write. You could write so much content.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's literally bottomless. So
I have on the sheet things that you want to talk about, things that you have ideas about, right? And one of them was prototyping for production. So I'm curious, mm-hmm. what's running through your mind on that topic?
So I actually do this. I do this as a lecture over at Miami University here locally in Cincinnati. And prototyping the production for me is really about there's some core principles in sort of the process that you design when you're prototyping a particular feature or a particular product, like a full product. That if you follow them and you sort of use these guiding principles, you can, make it really flexible. And so what you don't end up with is, a bunch of code that you end up throwing away at the end of the day. So, a lot of people won't take the time to invest when they're prototyping. They'll just try to get it done as quickly as possible and sort of building things in a very modular style. And if you, sort of focus on building the components and, the individual, maybe like services, if you think you're going to end up in like a service oriented architecture, and sort of focusing on the pieces of it, you can put together a pretty good Lego set for building a prototype that, will serve you as you even go into maybe future prototypes. Cause you can say, hey, I need a service that just, sends, newsletters or emails or, it, plugs into Twilio and, sends an SMS. And you sort of have those, those tools in your toolkit as you're going into prototyping. And so as you're going through the wireframe process and sort of identifying that, what I encourage anybody, that's engaging from a technical side to do is, not to look at, the features of what the product, not necessarily just the features that the product needs to accomplish or to do, but also, what are the building blocks that compose the particular system and focus on dividing those into chunks with really good sort of clean interfaces on them so that they can be reused. So even if you're focused on the wrong thing and you, decide, okay, this is a horrible idea. We, our market's telling us to go in a different direction. You still are able to sort of break apart those pieces and reuse them to quickly construct that next prototype. So you don't end up with one giant monolithic piece of code that, then ends up needing to be completely re-engineered when you actually go to just, even if it is successful, even to scale it, right?
Oh, so you just write code the right way at the beginning?
Yeah. And I mean, so many people will just immediately go to, I'm just going to build it really quickly, right? Like, and they just start, they create one project and everything just gets slammed into that one project. And then when they go to change something, they spend the entire time chasing all the things that they broke because the code's just thrown together too quick.
Yeah, it only takes a long time to do it the right way if you don't know how to do it the right way.
Correct.
So people that run off to do the prototype, to do it as a prototype, it's like they've usually always done that. And then it's like, hold on a second, prototyper. Let's build a product.
Or let's take that and let's put that thing on two servers and see how it works, right? Like, right. Let's try to run it with a load balancer in front of it. Oh, now somebody's logged out. Interesting. that's always that, whenever I'm working with CS students, I always, tell them, I'm like, okay, what happens if there's two of these? Does it all still work? Is there, are you sharing resources correctly? Are you using, is the app built state, in the correct stateless, formats? So,
and that's kind of why you, I guess, like Go, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Because it was built with those concepts. It was like Google's approach as what if we build a language today, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what do you, in your mind, the differences between director of engineering and CTO, what kind of immediately stands out as like some bullet points differences to you?
Well, I mean, director of engineering largely is, while my CTO roles in the past have been, with startups that are sort of wearing that, you know, director of engineering hat. You know, largely this was a space where I knew that I didn't necessarily immediately come in with all of the knowledge that I needed just inside of the, you know, the sort of ecosystem. And so for me, I was sort of, you know, happy to take that director of engineering position to sort of learn what I needed to in that role and get the, you know, the two people who developed and have operated in this space as mentors to sort of, you know, help me grow and learn what I needed to in this particular ecosystem. You know, the main things that stand out is, you know, as we build the team, you know, the director of engineering, largely I'm going to be the one defining what the processes are, how the team works, how we plug into the other, you know, groups that are inside of the organization. While the CTO would take on those responsibilities without a VP or a director of engineering, you know, in this particular instance, you know, the CTOs that we have are so close to the problem set that we're solving and such experts in it that, you know, it just makes sense for them to sort of focus on, you know, how do we continue to make sure that we have really great product market fit and we're servicing the customer. And then I can take on all of the implementation and taking this out to the market.
Excellent. Cause like when you take the mark, like, okay, so, but you just caused fireworks to happen in my head. So at the same time you're talking about that, we got a question from the live stream says, you know, what if someone builds your idea and they steal it in like less than 6 months from the time you're able to talk about it until the time you engineer it? And at the same time, it's like, well, if you don't take your product out into the world and get feedback and start understanding like who your tribe is, who your audience is, then you don't even know if what you're building is useful.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, part of that prototyping talk that I give is how fast can you set up your product feedback loop or your feature feedback loop, right? Like, you know, if you're, yeah. You can immediately get feedback on wireframes, right? I've seen entire companies raise money on Envision Studio, like Envision, you know, sort of like, you know, demos.
Oh, I did this. I did this.
And, you know, but if you get that feedback, then you're actually iterating and already starting to turn the ship towards what the customers are saying provides value and what they'll pay for. If you're not focused on that, like you might as well not be, you know, you're going to end up 6 months down the road and you're going to wonder why it didn't hit the market.
That's exactly the case. Also, it's cheaper. So I did an app, a fitness related app with a company that was like, did fitness stuff. And they were like, oh, we want to build that. This is a version one. We want to build it. I said, well, what if we just, it's funny because I'm taking less money to just do something I think would be a better way to do it, right? So I said, let's not build the app. Let's instead build a fully like functioning Envision prototype. And you can take this prototype around with you on your phones to the gyms and like walk up to people or ask your gym customers and like have them tap through the app and like ask them what they think. And they're like, oh, this is really cool. And then they did that at scale with, you know, probably 50 to 150 people. And then we did an iteration and they went out and talked to 50 people, then an iteration. And we basically iterated the entire thing with just a designer hooking it up in Envision and us. Mm-hmm. And we got through that whole process. We weren't having to change code. We weren't having to change models. We weren't having to rewrite stuff. Like we didn't have to do any of that. And I instantly thought like, oh man, I'm so happy Envision exists. This is such a better way to do it.
But at the same time, all of that iterations going on, you're off to the side sort of, you know, scoping your pieces so that when it is time to build stuff, you're sort of slowly accumulating. And then, you know, you're not waiting 6 months to take it to the market. The development time is largely cut short, you know, because you're cutting all of your rework and you've already got a good idea of what the data flows look like inside of your app.
Oh, absolutely. It's cheaper, faster, and we know people want it.
Yep.
Like that's just recipe for success, right?
Pretty much.
Yeah. So I'm pumped about that. Okay. So did you watch the Rocket thing yesterday?
I did. It was crazy.
How pumped were you about that?
As a kid who went through space camp, like to see what he's doing, you know, I mean, and, you know, to land both stages right next to each other, because, you know, that's just the flair that was needed for something along those lines. I mean, it could have been a complete, like, watching both of them topple and the largest explosion in the world. And he still would have been like, oh, you know, first time we tried it, whatever. But he stuck the landing on both of those. And it was just like, yeah, okay, all right, yep, there it is.
It was so beautiful. I'm so happy because, like, the whole industry, all the investors, everyone's, like, pro space. Like, that was important for the whole industry. You know?
Correct. Yeah. I mean, even the competitors, right?
Right.
It just proves, you know, the you know, private space flight and, you know, the investment that, you know, NASA's put into sort of driving into that is it's proving to be the right way. I mean, again, you know, if you allow innovators and money to flow into it and, you know, there's good business there, then there's probably going to be good stuff done there.
Yeah. Cause if you think about it, there's some families, a mother, father, and son and daughter who are sitting there watching mm-hmm. that. And they land successful and everyone goes hooray. And the kids are like, I want to be astronauts. And like, I want to, I want to go work in space. They'd be like, yeah, you could do it. Like, awesome. Like, that's going to be where, but if those things would have blown up, the parents would have been like, good luck. No, you know, like, we'll see. And then like everybody would have been negative about it. So I was really pulling for it to work out successfully.
Completely agree.
Did you hear our Mike Anderson episode?
I did not, no.
Okay, I suggest it. And because he builds satellites and the rockets and runs like a team at NASA and a team as private company. And they are they're building a system right now that's going to go up in a rocket, grapple with Landsat 7, a 2-ton satellite mid-orbit and refuel it, and then like go bring food to the space station.
Wow. Okay, yeah, good luck with that, right?
So yeah. So he told us about kind of how they do that and robotics. And it's because it's curious. It's like, all right, well, you know, we write code and it's important that the code runs or like whatever it may be. And obviously we do. Like in our world, people consider test optional. Like if you go talk to 100 people, 50 of them say, oh, tests are optional. I mean,
yeah.
Talk to 100 experts, tests are not optional. But the general consensus, but like when you put something into space, there's like test models, like everything you have. Small replica models, life-size models at NASA's plant. You run it over and over and over with the brightest people on Earth and run everything. And then it's like an autonomous mission. It's insane.
Yeah. And then lo and behold, like there's still something that's minutely, you know, messed up because, you know, you just don't know until you're there, right? Doing it. Because what is it? Opportunity on Mars ran into something like that. So,
yeah. So we're wishing the best for Mike Anderson's 2-ton refuel. I'm super pumped. He also does a robotics. His company donates some of their profit to Robotics First, which is this program that teaches kids in school about robotics and how to be roboticists.
Nice.
Really cool. And he goes, I feel like it's my duty because when I'm laying like on my deathbed, I might be on one of the respirators and I don't want their embedded systems to like dump memory or crash.
Well, I'm glad his motivations are in the right spot then, I guess.
I know, it's hilarious. It's like, I consider myself pretty nerdy, but I don't build embedded systems, so I wouldn't have gone there. But it, like, it's just so interesting how much we rely on technology. Those are systems, those human, there's like this whole study. Have you ever come across human factors engineering?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that stuff is so interesting, man. Like you use technology, but then you use it in high pressure life and death situations. And like, and then you get these marketing people that are like, I'm a usability expert. It's like, it's just such an interesting spectrum of like the different roles that exist. There's so much technology compared to 20 years ago when I was growing up. I'm 30 now. But I mean, no one had phones in school and there was barely internet. Except for at my dad's office, really, you know, it's insane. Now everyone's in this life cycle and their business is a part of it.
Yeah. It's the whole IoT stuff that's coming out is just, you know, it's crazy to watch some of that stuff. Cause there hasn't been sort of that major acquisition yet inside of that market, but you know, you're starting to see some of your major players sort of come out in that space, both from, you know, some of them are focused on medical, some of them on light manufacturing or manufacturing and just asset tracking. It's, you know, it's interesting the amount of data and how dependent we're becoming on all of the networks and just connectivity of individual things.
The future, like I'm really excited for 20 years in the future. Like it's going to be crazy. Your company is going to be like revolutionizing the software programming world with your building codes or whatnot.
We hope.
So if Elon Musk, he's super excited, does his rocket launch, and then he calls you up and he's like, Brian, you have to come over to my house. I built a time machine. You get to jump in it and go back 10 years. What would you tell your previous self 10 years ago?
You know, I don't know if I would go back. You know, I mean, it's such a, you know, ridiculous answer, but I don't know if I'd go back and change anything, because a lot of the stuff that I've learned has been through, you know, an amazing mentor network that, you know, I continue to rely on. And, you know, some of those mentors have come and I've gotten really close with them simply out of some of the missteps that I've made and sort of searching for help. And so, you know, that need to go back and sort of redo things, I feel like would change where I'm at and the opportunities that I have in front of me so much that, you know, you can end up in a completely different spot, right? You could end up with, you know, things just not being right in life, I guess.
So Elon Musk was not happy with that answer, and he has now pulled out a ray gun.
Okay. Says,
you have to go in. You don't have to change anything. And this is not me. This is Musk, dude. So take it out on him.
All right, fine.
You don't have to change anything, right?
Yep.
And actually nothing that you would say to yourself could change anything. We're protected here in this loop, okay? Just a piece of advice, just a little something you would say to yourself, like buy Bitcoin or don't step on that trash can or read Martin Fowler's book sooner or, you know, go invent Golang, like anything you would like. What would you tell yourself 10 years ago?
Yeah, I probably would have told myself 10 years ago that, you know, it took me a while to rely on my mentor network. And so, you know, if I could have, you know, pushed myself a little bit more as I was younger to say, you know, there's a lot of people out there who have, you know, they, you know, if you're the smartest person in the room, you're probably in the wrong room. Right. And so make sure that you're surrounding yourself with people that constantly push you and can help you, and to just be willing to ask for help, because, you know, a lot of times, you know, I was, you know, when I was really young, it was like, oh, well, I can do this, not a problem. And then when I failed, I was like irritated with myself. And really what I should have done is I should have just, you know, sort of included more people in the process of tackling a problem and surrounded myself with the right people to sort of increase my chances of success very early on in my career, I'd say.
Excellent. So you mentor network.
Mentor network, big time.
Mentor network.
Yeah.
All right. Elon Musk put the gun away. He's now giving you a free Tesla.
He's hugging me just, now. He wants to be my mentor. Yeah.
As soon as you sign the non-disclosure about the gun thing. Oh, thank you so much, Brian, for coming on the call today. It was super exciting.
Yep, I enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening to the Modern CTO podcast. Share this, get the word out. Thank you guys so much. I couldn't do it without you. I appreciate it. You guys are the absolute best.